it seems to be getting progressively more heavier.
Yeah, no, I can understand. And, yeah, I mean, I'm just going to leave it recording, then I'll give you guys...
Would you rather have the WAV file or would you rather have an MP3 file when it's all said and done? The WAV file is going to be pretty big, but I can go ahead and encode it to an MP3 if you want it. You just have to, like, edit, you know, put it back into Audacity or, you know, GarageBand or something just to cut it down. Okay, yeah. All right, that's fine. Yeah, no worries.
Okay.
All right, yep, we should be good.
Okay, so we're recording?
We are recording. We are live.
Okay, so this is Alex Wall. I'm here with Whitney Roberts. We're at Logan Arcade. And it is November 21st. Okay, so we're just going to start with questions about your collection, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So what exactly do you collect?
I collect classic arcade games, and most recently, I'd say within the past year and a half or so, I've gotten into pinball machines as well.
Okay. I actually missed... the most important question.
That's okay. If you want to start over, that's fine.
Do you have any questions for me before we begin, actually?
No. I think we've talked everything through. So I'm good. I'm comfortable.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So back to your collection.
Yep.
Do you look for anything more specific? Like, is there anything, like, lately that you've been collecting more of than you used to? Or?
You know, It's a situation where over time you kind of curate the collection and what you're after. So when I first started into the hobby, I was after just about anything that I could find, because it was like, oh wow, I had no idea that I could buy these arcade games and put them in a game room or in my house and play these games and relive, you know, a portion of my childhood. And so initially, I just kind of went gangbusters and was all over the place thinking, I'll buy this, I'll buy this, I'll buy this, I'll fix this up. You know, no project is too far gone. I've got all the time in the world to make all these things look brand new. As the years kind of tick by, then you start to realize it's like, okay, this takes a significant amount of time, effort, and investment, and you definitely become much more picky in what you go after. So just recently, I've picked up a game that I had been on the hunt for a little over 6 years, and at this point, I don't really have that much left that I'm after. I've been pretty fortunate. I've been able to find a fair amount of what I've been after over the years.
Okay. So when did you start collecting?
I would say back in the late 2007, early 2008 time frame is when I really got into this in earnest. But I had never really, I guess, kind of gotten out of this hobby. It had just kind of lied dormant for several years while I was, you know, building my career, finishing college, and starting a family, doing all of that type of stuff. And then this really kind of picked itself back up once I found that I had some time and needed to devote my energies and my, you know, and I guess just, you know, my attention to something that I thought was constructive. Yeah. So I'd say between 6 and 7 years. Yeah.
So you also say that you restore things mm-hmm. on your website, I believe. So what do you typically restore? And is that just for, you know, your own to be able to use these things, or is it just to bring them back to their prime, or
yes. And so, you know, I mean, that's a kind of a multifaceted question. I mean, one of the big things about this hobby, and once you get into the thick of it, then and as we're sitting here at Logan's, you know, the owner Jim Zespy's got a lot of very nice games, and what you have to kind of keep in mind is that all of these machines are 30 years old. So none of us drive cars that are probably half that old, you know, and most of the time, anytime you see a car that's over 25 years old, it has, you know, it has like classic registration tags on it and things like that, and it's considered an antique. Well, these games, by their very nature today, are antiques, and they're running computers and TVs that have lasted 25 to 30 years. So when you talk about restoring them, It's more so about looking over the condition of the machine, of the cabinet, and then doing whatever woodwork's necessary to make them suitable for being inside your house, because that's one of the biggest problems that we tend to have, is these games are a lot of times not in the best of condition because of their storage or lack thereof, or in how they've been taken care of over the past 30 years or lack thereof. I mean, most of the games are somewhere between decent in a basket case, and so in order to make them something that you'd want to have inside your house, you've got to do a lot of cleanup work, usually some woodwork, some Bondo, and reapplying artwork and things like that. And so you do it to preserve the machine, but also to make sure that you're not bringing in a rat-infested, you know, crate of wood, you know, into your basement. So it serves several purposes, but mainly to preserve what you just cannot get any longer.
Okay. I'm sure this is probably a hard question to answer, but what would you say is your favorite item that you have collected?
My favorite item that I've collected. Do I have to just narrow it down to one?
Unless you have like a series of things.
No, not really. I mean, my favorite item by far is what's considered a factory red Nintendo Donkey Kong machine. They're very rare, very hard to come by. Took me quite a while to hunt one down, and so I would say that would probably be my most, I guess my most treasured, if you want to use that word, but it's probably my favorite piece in the collection. Right behind that would be a game called Zookeeper from Taito, and that's a very rare game, and that's the game that I had previously alluded to taking over 6 years to hunt down before I was finally able to get one. They're just uber rare and they're very unreliable. They're hard to keep running, but it's such a fun game. But those two.
So is there anything that you have wanted in your collection so bad but you haven't been able to obtain it?
You know, that changes over time, and you know, as I've gotten a little bit older, my tastes have changed a little bit. I tend to change my outlook on items like that, but as of today, I've pretty much been able to get everything that I've wanted or have been after, and I don't want this to sound passé or anything, but there's really not anything that I'm on the hunt for right now. I mean, over time you'll come across deals and you'll find this or you'll find that. But major titles, I've gotten what I've been after. I mean, I wouldn't turn down a good deal on a game, but at the same point, right now, today, I'm not actively hunting anything at all. So,
okay. So, how do you typically collect these? How do you come about them? Like, who do you talk to, or what are your resources for finding these?
Okay, when I first started into the hobby and didn't really know anyone who also does this collecting and restoring hobby as well, you pretty much had to resort to eBay, you know, finding machines on eBay or maybe Craigslist or something along those lines, and those can still be avenues today. Definitely Craigslist far more than eBay, but I guess eBay is kind of where I got started, but then very quickly graduated over to, you know, just doing, you know, city and statewide searches with Craigslist, and then from there you build up a network of people in the community. I mean, like, you know, we're sitting here and Jim Zespy's a great example of someone who's very plugged into the community and has a lot of reach and knows a lot of people, and over time in the community, then you just get to know people, you know where to go to find certain games or certain parts and things like that. So it starts one way, but it always ends up, you know, just building your network and the friends that you have and the connections that you make. I'm not buying games off eBay any longer. Let's put it that way. Yeah. Way too much money, and you can almost always do better than that.
So you mentioned your Donkey Kong. Is there anything that you have is more rare than that in your collection?
The Zookeeper is definitely very rare. As far as anything that's more rare than that, I would say I do have an Atari Food Fight, which is very rare as well. Thinking back through the rest of the collection, an upright Atari Star Wars, which is fairly rare, but not uber rare like Zookeeper is, or very rare like Food Fight is. Have a Q-Bert, and they're semi-rare, okay? The Red Donkey Kong is very rare, and outside of that, an Atari Gravatar and Atari Black Widow, they're fairly rare, but outside of that, most everything else is kind of run-of-the-mill.
So, have you ever had to do anything crazy to collect an item?
I have, yes. I mean, I've traveled, I've traveled to many states to go pick up these games. I've stayed overnight in my car. I have done horrendous road trips. I remember one time I was actually working with Jim, and he helped me locate a game. And I'd driven my truck up here to Chicago to pick up the game. And the weather was great on the way up, but on the way back, ran into a snowstorm like around West Lafayette, up around Purdue University, and was completely and utterly just, blizzarded in, and had to pull off the side of the road into a gas station, unload the game, wrap it in a tarp, and then load it back up, and drive home in the blizzard. And when I got home, there was at least an inch of snow on that game, and when I unwrapped it, I was like, oh, man, I'm glad that it didn't get tore up or anything like that, waterlogged. But there's others, but I think that game and that trip probably tested my mettle more than anything else, because I had a friend with me, and he was like, I'm never doing this again. I'm never doing this again, and as we were into it, I somewhat questioned my own sanity as well. It's the things you'll do for it's the things you'll do for the hobby.
So what is the oldest thing that you've collected?
The oldest thing that I have collected, I would say that would be a Donkey Kong is 1981. I don't know if you guys have heard of Asteroids from Atari. That's 79. That's probably the oldest game that, yes, definitely. That is the oldest game that I have in my collection. So I don't have any pinball machines that are that old. Just the arcade games. I've only got a few pinball machines, and they're all fairly to very new. So, yeah.
And what's the newest thing?
Chronologically or acquisition?
Chronologically.
Chronologically, it would be an Iron Man. It would be an Iron Man Vault Edition pinball machine from Stern. It was just released earlier this year, 2014. And so that would chronologically, that's the newest thing in the collection. In my game room, I guess.
So, do you typically play most of the games that you have in your collection?
I do. I don't get to play them near as much as one would think that one should for the time and the money and the effort that one spends on collecting these games. But truth be told, as much fun as it is to play the games, it's equally as much fun for me to repair them and to fix them and to restore them and to clean them up and to, just talk with friends and acquaintances in the hobby and just to have some fellowship. I mean, I think that's as much fun, if not more, than the game, than actually playing the games themselves. But I do have a rule, though, that, when I bring in a game, I don't start playing it as soon as I get it unless it's in fairly good shape. Otherwise, I will kind of break it down and clean it and get it restored, new artwork and things like that, because, I mean, I'm fairly OCD when it comes to that. I like the games to look good. I like them to be clean. I don't want them smelling like a rat's nest inside my house. And, it's 30-year-old wood that's been sitting in a barn or something. I try to do my best to get them cleaned up before I play them. So I have far less to play than I have to fix at this point. But, that's all part of the fun.
So going back to restorations,
yeah.
What's probably the most rare or extremely valuable thing that you've restored?
I would have to say so far it's probably been my red Donkey Kong. I mean, street value, those are probably right around $1,000, maybe a little bit more, just based upon the rarity and in the condition there. The other, like the Zookeeper that I just got, would command much more than that, but it's going through the teardown phase right now. So a lot of my other games outside of the Food Fight and maybe the Black Widow and the Gravatar, like I say, a lot of my other games are, Burger Time, Frogger, Miss Pac-Man, stuff like that aren't extremely valuable. So you just try to make sure that you get them in really good condition so that you don't have to sink a lot of time into them. But I would say that.
Are certain things harder to get than others to obtain?
Oh, by far, yes, by far. So some of the vector games, kind of like Atari Star Wars and Atari Tempest and Black Widow and Gravatar, Quantum, Major Havoc, things like that. The Atari Vectors are harder to come by than a lot of the other games. Some of the Nintendo games are very hard to come by, just depending upon what you're after and what condition. But you know, things like Food Fight, Zookeeper, others like Nibbler and Timber. You know, just there's a whole host of games that are uber rare and very collectible. Even though they may not be all that fun, they're just very hard to come by. You just have to gauge it that way. But then other games like Ms. Pac-Man and Asteroids and Space Invaders, I hate to say this, but even today, they're very, very plentiful. You know, I don't want to say cheap and dime a dozen, because that would infer the wrong thing. But I think you get the drift of where I'm coming from. If you wanted to get a Ms. Pac-Man, even today, it's relatively easy to do it. Yeah.
So, going to your experience with games in general, and your history with them, what would you say are some of your favorite memories from going to the arcades?
Oh man, yeah, this is neat, and it's probably one of the biggest drivers for the reason why I even got into this hobby. But I grew up on a farm in rural Kentucky, and so my family and my brother, my mother, my father, and my brother and I were very bound to the farm. We did a lot of manual labor. We had a lot of days, a lot of weeks, a lot of months where there wasn't really a whole lot of quote unquote fun things to do. And so my mother would always take my brother and I on weekends. She would always take us to the grocery store with her, and then a little bit later one consignment store. And so she would always drop us off at the arcade that was right next to the grocery store, and my brother and I would take our money that we'd saved up, and for a couple of hours on a Saturday, we had fun, and different fun. I mean, we had a lot of fun growing up, don't get me wrong, but that was like hunting and fishing and riding three-wheelers and four-wheelers and things like that. The arcade was just such a complete and utter it was just a stark difference from our day-to-day routine that it was something special to us. And I've kind of carried that forward ever since being a kid. So, we didn't grow up, when I was growing up, I had no internet, I wasn't able to take my pick of places to go, like in a city like Chicago. It just didn't exist. So the small things and the simple things really meant a lot to us. So I think that's the reason why I've just gravitated towards this from that point on.
So I think you mentioned this in your blog. Is that arcade that you were talking about Galaxy of Games?
Or? Yes, it is. Yeah, the Galaxy of Games in Frankfurt. It's long since gone. Long since gone, though.
Okay. Do you have a favorite arcade?
I would say here at Logan's. It's one that I've been to many, many times, and Jim is a very good friend of mine, and he has helped me out. I've tried to help him out, and this feels like home away from home for me. So I would say this one by far. There are many, many great arcades though all across the United States. You would think that today in 2014, for a business to showcase 30-year-old pieces of computer equipment, that it just wouldn't be a viable business model. But more and more arcades are cropping up today, or this within the past year to 2 years, and I would say have been in the past 10. So it's almost like on a pendulum swing and kind of on its way back up. It's pretty amazing. I visited quite a few. There are some very, very big ones all across the United States. But I like Jim's. I like it. It just feels like home.
Okay. So how did you come to Chicago?
How did I come to Chicago? It was for work. I came here, the work that I do, I have customers here that I had some business with and had to visit. And so it's nice. I was, everything's done as of today, and I had the evening free. So I figured I would just stay over and visit with Jim before I have to get up in the morning and drive back home. So it was business, but I try to make sure that I can pack in at least a night or something of enjoying Chicago before I have to go back home. Because I will say this, as much as I love Kentucky, it's not Chicago and it's not like Chicago. So you try to take in, the local scene while you can, because it's not like I can get back up here, it's 7, 8, 9, 10 times a year. Yeah.
So I think I saw something about a pinball event happening in Chicago recently?
Yes, yes. It was the called the Pinball Expo, and is the 30th anniversary, and that was just about, I think, 5 weeks or so ago as we're recording this. So, yeah, from what I understand, the largest pinball show in the world, and the oldest pinball show in the world. So
it was a very, very fun time. It was neat.
If you like pinball, there was days and days and days worth of it, miles and miles.
So do you have a favorite game?
A favorite game. Yeah, and as cliched as it is Donkey Kong. I know a lot of people will say that, and you probably, if you were to poll 100 people in the arcade, they would say, they'd probably say Donkey Kong maybe 50% of the time. I know it's very popular. I know it's received a lot of press over the past several years, but it's always the machine that confounded me the most and caused me the most consternation when I was a kid, and I loved it. So, and I still do to this day. I love it.
Is it more because of the history you have with it, or maybe like the technical aspects of it, the difficulty of it, or
it's pieces and parts of all of that, you know, because when I was in the arcade as a young man, I mean, Donkey Kong was very new, and I remember the first time that I saw it. I remember the crowd that would gather around it. I remember seeing that there would be, across the marquee, you know, where it's lit up, where the name of the game is, there would be quarters just stretched down the marquee, and people would be playing and just, you know, yeah, and just yelling and screaming, and it was, I mean, it was almost like a rave club before there was ever such a thing, you know, and you walk in, and it's like, man, this is something pretty special.
And I saw that.
I saw degrees of that to other games, but Donkey Kong always seemed to, you know, command a presence back in the day, you know, using
air quotes for that.
And the other part of the answer, though, it's definitely the difficulty, because that game is notoriously famous for being extremely hard, random, and punishing. And so very few people master it. Many people will spend years trying, and I'm still no good at it, but I still. You know,
it's the greatest thing in the world. You can walk up to it,
be completely self-absorbed in it for about maybe 6 or 7 minutes,
and then you go
and beat your head against your hand against the table and walk off, cool off, and come back and say, "I'm going to play again." So it has a high replay value. It's just a lot of fun.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about arcade gaming and pinball but. Do you have any interest in modern gaming, like console gaming, or?
I do. I do. I mean, as a kid, I had an Atari 2600 and the original Nintendo Entertainment System, the NES. And I was real big into consoles at that point in time. Fast forward to today, I do have an Xbox One, and I like it and I play it, but it's. Not as into the consoles by any stretch of the imagination as I am the classic scene. You know, I mean, I really appreciate what modern console gaming is today. It's beautiful. The games are definitely works of art. But I feel time and time again as I play the more modern games, a lot of times I'll even become distracted and think, I'm just going to go play Donkey Kong. Play Donkey Kong, you know, it's like Call of Duty. This is so pretty, but it's so complex. I think I'll just get here and go play Donkey Kong. Yeah, there's something to be said for that.
So, on modern console gaming, what do you think about indie games? And
I love them.
What would be your favorite indie game, and why?
Well, from an indie game perspective, my exposure to that is really on the arcade side, okay? And there is a group of developers, some that are actually even local to me, where I live in Kentucky, that are building brand new arcade games, cabinets and everything, monitors, the whole nine yards, and they're creating their own indie games to go into these arcade cabinets. I've seen a couple of them at shows. There's been, I would say, a litany of them out there. One that stands out to me, though, is Solomon's Temple. It's a fantastic game from a developer that is over in Southern Indiana. A very fun game. I've gotten to play it at a couple of expos. But as far as, like, if you're asking, like, about indie console gaming, I really don't know enough to answer that question in that regard. So I apologize for that. You know, I probably stick more to the mainstream, you know, titles like, you know, Halo and stuff like that, you know, Modern Warfare, Call of Duty, and I'm aware of all of those. Even though I may not play all of those, I still stay up on all of those. But the indie gaming scene, like on the consoles, I realize I would have to spend a lot of time on the console to go through a lot of the indie games in order to have any, you know, I guess, level of familiarity with them. And I just don't have the time to do that.
So your website mentions something called MAME, or M-A-M-E?
Yeah, yes, MAME. Yeah, the Multiple Arcade Machine Emulator, yes.
So could you describe that, explain more about it?
Sure, yeah. So MAME, and I'm just giving you my interpretation of it, kind of the layman's explanation of it as I understand it. But MAME is a piece of open source software. It's been ported to Windows, Linux, Mac, several other platforms as well. And the goal of MAME is to preserve the gameplay and the ROMs that are dumped off of the older classic arcade boards so that these games can be studied and can be preserved and be played long after the machines disappear. So if you were to turn, sitting right behind you, this is a Budweiser Tapper, okay? There's not many of them out there. They are fairly rare games. The thing about it is, though, is that if all the tappers off the face of the earth were to disappear, okay, Bally's, as they existed when Tapper, Q-Bert, Burger Time, Miss Pac-Man, Frogger, these companies are no longer, by and large, are no longer in business today. So no one's making new Frogger machines, or no one's making new Donkey Kong machines. So if they've all been destroyed, if they all disappear, then the computer boards that are inside them likely suffered the same fate. So the MAME team, their goal is to dump all of the code off of the boards and then emulate the boards in software so that you can still play the games, even if the games are no longer available at some point in the future. So if we were to fast forward 3 or 4 or 5 generations, or some of these games are just, let's say, no longer available, or you can't get parts for them to fix them or repair them, MAME is always an option for at least playing the game. It's not meant as a method to pirate the games and play the games for free. It is more so for documentation and for historical preservation. But the side effect of that is that you can play the games.
Also going on that, how are you, or are you involved with anything that has to do with MAME?
I am not. No, okay. No, sir, I am not. I used to work with it quite a bit several years back. Built what's called a MAME cabinet, where you put in a monitor. It's done in the same vein as an arcade cabinet. Size, shape, dimensions, things like that. Put in a computer and then play MAME, and it's like a multi, you can think of like a multi-arcade machine, I guess, but that was very, very early on before I started collecting the real games, and I don't really do a whole lot with MAME any longer. But I'm definitely not involved with the MAME project, or I don't contribute any work to the MAME project at all.
So going back to the arcade experience, what were probably some of your favorite moments, maybe getting a high score or beating your brother or something?
Well, I'm not a very good player, so high scores never really were anything that were ever, you know, that was ever in my reach. It was more so just about the ambience, the aura of the games, just the I guess just the whole environment that you walked into when you were in an arcade back in the day. Definitely my brother was with me. We would play and have a really good time. So there's definitely memories of doing that as well. And then also just finding arcade games as we would take trips, and you'd see them pop up in random places, you know, laundromats or, you know, 7-Elevens, whatever. And it was always just fun to see them on location and to see and to play them and support them. So it would have to be that. I never really got into the competition scene or the high score scene or anything like that. I just always tried to have fun.
So how do you feel like playing in an arcade environment, how does that compare to not playing in an arcade environment?
Well, I mean, playing in an arcade environment like this is definitely great, because I think that it's important to seek out these arcades as they exist today and support them and throw some business their way and make sure that they're able to keep their doors open, because there's going to be – hopefully the microphones will cancel some of that out. So,
thank you.
That's awesome. He did us a solid. So, anyway, getting back to it, playing in these types of environments is definitely fun. Now, playing in your home game room is also a lot of fun, you know, with friends, family, whatever it may be. There are times when I prefer the home game room environment simply because you can control the volume, you can control the music, you can control your experience. But playing here in an arcade such as this, the experience kind of bleeds over into you. So some days I like one, some days I prefer the other. But either way, it is very important to support these local businesses that are doing this, because they've gone out on a limb to bring these games back to the general public and to form a business model on something that's no longer in vogue or in style, so to speak. And you can imagine what it must be like where your primary product is stuff you can't buy any longer, you know. So, yeah, that's it.
Okay. Just going to take a quick second. Actually,
yeah, no problem. Great thing is you can always edit anything out that you want, so it's no big deal.
So, I keep saying so. Over time, arcades have obviously changed. What would you say are the best things that have changed about them? The worst things, and how do you see arcades, what do you see is in the future for them?
Okay, so let's kind of break the question down. So some of the best things that have changed, I guess, is the simple fact that they're still here. And so the business model has definitely changed. Many of the arcades today do not operate on just, you know, quarter per play type of scenario, and that's the only thing that they have going on inside the arcade. Many arcades today are kind of like a sidecar business along with something else, like a bar, like a restaurant, or, you know, maybe even a movie theater or something along those lines, a bowling alley or something like that. So I think the business model, even though it is the same, you know, to some degree it's the same at its core for the product that's being offered up, the good thing is that we've seen them change somewhat over time and kind of meld to, you know, more modern days. As far as some of the things that I'm not real happy about seeing change is just the simple fact that the industry had to fold, or for lack of better terms, near fold, in order for everyone, I think, to really start to place a significant value on the games that were left. Now, that being said, there are still companies here today, like Williams Gaming here in Chicago, that are still in business, and Bally that still produce games, but it's nowhere near the heyday like it was back in the early late 70s and early 80s. And what was the third part of the question? I'm sorry. You said what I like, and I guess what I like has changed, and
the worst parts. And,
yeah.
Oh, where do you see the future of
arcades? Thank you. I apologize for that. where do I see it going over the next 10 years or so? Truthfully, I see this model, like we're sitting in here today, continuing to thrive and continuing to go, because over the past 3 or 4 years, this model here has really caused the arcade scene to experience somewhat of a rebirth. And pinball is a huge part of that as well. I don't want to paint a picture that's all one-sided, because pinball is a thriving industry today. Now, That being said, it's, you know, we're still talking about something that may even be considered a niche hobby, so to speak. But at the same time, pinball is alive and well, and it's growing, you know, leaps and bounds. So it's very popular. It's making a very big comeback. Arcades are I think, experiencing some of that rub-off effect from the explosion or the growth of pinball. So I see them both kind of being married together and then riding along with, you know, another business venture such as a bar or restaurant and things like that. I don't ever really see just a pure, you know, return to the 80s arcade as we had 30 years ago. That being said, there's still some of them out there, but it's just not something you see a whole lot of.
So, do you consider yourself an avid video game player?
I consider myself an avid video game lover, but I don't get as much time to play as I would like to. No. Mm-mm. Okay. If I was going to classify myself as avid player, I would be, you know, I would be setting aside, you know, hours every day to play, and I just, you know, I have a career, I have commitments and responsibilities, and you know, the podcast and everything else. So, my time is spread a little thin, and I don't get to play near as much as I want to. And that's probably what keeps me interested in it, if you want to know the truth of it. Yeah.
So, have you been in or participated in any competitions?
I have.
Yes, I have. I've participated in a couple video game competitions that were held
by Mark Alpiger at ClassicArcadeGaming.com. For 2 years, or the 2 years that I participated, rather, they were held here in Chicago, here at Logan Hardware, and so I participated in those. I didn't do very well at all, but like I say, for me, it's just more so about the fun of it. So I didn't have any expectations of winning anything. It was more so, it just seemed like a fun thing to do.
Do you know any famous professional gamers?
I do. Yeah, I do. Some in passing. Some reasonably well. So, Mark Alpiger, he lives in Louisville, Kentucky. He's a world record holder. There's several others in the area, and of course, there's also the big, I guess, you know, kind of quote unquote the big names in the arcade gaming scene that I've met. I don't really know that well, but if you're in the hobby for any length of time and go to a few shows, chances are you're going to meet, you know, the circle of or the sphere of influencers, and so, you know, over the years you tend to meet quite a few people in that arena.
So, finally, on to Broken Token.
Yes.
To those who are listening or reading the transcript, what is Broken Token?
Well, Broken Token started out as just my attempt to try to give something back, I guess, to the arcade community. We're a small group of people. Growing, but you know, we're a small group of hobbyists, and there's a lot of good reference, let's say websites that are reference based and forum based and things like that. And I just really wanted to, you know, start a website where I just kind of, I guess for lack of a better term, just kind of recorded my history and what I worked on and what I did and how I fixed things, just so that I would have something to go back and look at and just not forget everything that I'd learned. Over time, that actually proved to be harder to do than I thought it was going to be. And so with, you know, career, family, and everything else, pouring the time into that site was massive. In making it, you know, making it into something was a big undertaking. So I kept with that, but was able to then meet up with a friend of mine, and we started talking about doing an audio podcast. And so Broken Token has really kind of, I guess, kind of morphed into that. I mean, we still do the website and still do the, you know, posts and everything like that, but most everything is now geared towards the audio podcast that we host and we put on once a month.
So how did you come up with the name?
How did we come up with the name? Or how did I come up with the name? Okay, I needed something that was, I guess for lack of a better term, it had some phonetic ring to it, and it kind of rolled off the tongue, and it was one word, and it rhymed, okay? So that's what I was after, and I wanted it to be something that still had some relevance to the classic arcade scene. So everybody's familiar with the token and what it is and everything like that. So Most of the games I bought were broken, so I thought, well, you know, you just kind of put two and two together, and then that's where it is. And honestly, you know, you've also got to think about the branding involved in that, because you have to register, you know, a website URL. You want to get, you know, a Twitter handle. You want to get, you know, a Facebook page or Instagram page or something, social media, and you want to try, you know, YouTube or whatever. You want to try to fold everything under one umbrella as best as you can. So I just wanted something that was one word, rhymed, rolled off the tongue, and was very easy to remember. And that's what I came up with.
How did you start it? Like getting funding, or what were some of the steps that you had to go through to be able to start it?
To start the website? Mm-hmm. Oh, it was pretty easy if you want to know the truth of it. I mean, I've got I'm in IT, and I've got a friend of mine who provides me with a, you know, server hosting space, and so I just you know, I started up the website myself, and I do, you know, I do all the work on the website myself, and so I don't really hire any of it out. So you know, my podcast co-host Brent and I, we do the audio podcast every month, and we kind of split our duties up with that, responsibilities up with that. But I do essentially maintain the website, and it's just all been, you know, a labor of love and just a time commitment. But as far as like money or anything like that, it makes absolutely zero. It's all just, you know, for the hobby and the love of it, and just to have something, you know, just to be able to put a name, you know, and I hate to say label it is something, but just to have it as a name and be something that's identifiable, have a logo, and, you know, and be, I guess, kind of known in the community. And we have a lot of listeners, and they really enjoy it. So they really enjoy the, you know, the podcast. So it's just a labor of love, and we just kind of do it on our own time, and that's that. Have a very understanding family. How about that?
Are you influenced by any other blogs or people?
Oh yes.
Do you have a favorite blog?
As far as blogs go, I don't really have a favorite blog per se. But I have been influenced by several blogs. One run by a gentleman named Jeff Rothy. He runs a blog called Roth Blog, where he's a collector out of Indianapolis. And, you know, I've read his blog for several years before I decided to start my own. I would say that's probably one of the inspirations for, I guess, the idea to turn it into something of my own. But again, you know, kind of model it off of something at the same time. There's a litany of other blogs that are available out on the internet, you know, that are available on the internet. I'm trying to think of any others. There's one that's run by a gentleman down in Florida. His company is GameStencils.com, and he runs a restoration blog, and it's a fantastic resource, you know, website, you know, full of information and just, you know, fun to read what other people have done. Another friend of mine, his name's Jeff Waldron. He has a website called jeffsgames.com, and he has detailed years worth of his restorations on that blog. And it's just neat to see what other people do and what they record. But as far as other podcasts and things like that, oh, yeah, we're definitely influenced by that. I mean, to be very frank, I mean, we're not the first, and, you know, to go down either the roads that we've gone down. So, yeah, there's definitely other podcasts that are out there. Game Room Junkies is one, Spooky Pinball. Arcade Outsiders, Retro Gaming Roundup, you know, Coast to Coast Pinball, just, you know, the list kind of goes on and on. You know, No Quarter Podcast, you know, 10 Pence Arcade. There's a lot of media out there, and I'll be very frank and very honest. You know, we in this community, we all try to support each other, and we all, I think, probably listen to each other's shows. And so, you know, you get ideas and you hear stuff, and it's like, you know what, I want to expand on that on my show. And so you'll dig into a topic, you know, a little bit deeper, or you'll get, you know, you'll do an interview, or, you know, you're, let's say, detailing the restoration of a game or something like that, and then other people will pick up on it and discuss it. And so, you know, you see the information kind of run the circles a little bit, but it is good because, you know, you would think that there's nothing new to talk about on machines that are 30 years old, but every month or every week or every month, there seems to be a lot of, you know, a lot of media that, you know, that is devoted to these topics. So, oh yeah, so we definitely have influences.
So we talked about the podcast. what other things, like articles or events or contests, do you post those kind of things?
Well, we've not really started in to organizing like any formalized events or anything like that. I really don't know that we will. I know that I don't have the time to run one right now, just from, you know, just a time commitment standpoint and career and everything like that. And it's hard. I mean, it requires, you know, months and months of planning. And other people, you know, in the hobby are putting on very successful shows, expos, and you know, and things like that. And so we pretty much just participate, you know, in those. I don't really foresee us starting one of our own at this point in time.
I don't remember if we discussed when you started Broken
okay.
Token exactly, but if you would like to go over like the exact date per se, like when it started, and then maybe talk about how you think it has developed and grown, and how
okay.
you've developed and grown through the experience.
Sure, sure. Okay, so thinking back on the website, I want to say, without looking at it, I believe I started it somewhere around 2009. I believe, if memory serves me correctly. And when I first started, it was just me, and I was doing my best to detail, you know, what I was doing and put it in a, you know, a postable format and everything like that. And then over the years after starting the podcast, I think our focus has expanded and grown a little bit. But as far as how it's changed, you know, it's funny because the podcast and the website has been a vehicle to meet a lot of people and to make a lot of new friends. And so I would say that if there's anything that I would consider positive that has come out of the effort on the website and the effort on the podcast, is just the new friends that I've made and just the people that I've met, the relationships that have been created and things like that. I'll be very honest with you. Collecting the games is fun. Restoring the games is fun. But the eight or just a box that sits over in the corner, and you know, nothing really takes the place of people and the interaction with people, your friends, family, and things like that. So it's afforded me the opportunity to do a lot in that regard, and I really appreciate that. I guess I'd probably answer both questions with one answer. That's probably the better way to say that. So
does anybody help you maintain Broken Token?
No, it's just me. It's just me. I've had to learn a lot of, you know, graphics design, you know, skills and things like that I just never had. You know, I didn't go to school as a graphic artist or anything like that. So, you know, a lot of Photoshop and Illustrator and things like that, I've just had to kind of pick up on my own. But now I do it all myself.
What are typically the topics that your podcasts cover?
Okay. So our show typically covers a mix of topics, but I would say from a recurring theme perspective, you know, the things that we probably gravitate on most every show is just what's going on in the industry, what's new, what's notable, what's happening out there. And then we just talk about, you know, what we've done over the past month, you know, to our collection, what we may have acquired, what we may have fixed, what may have broke, you know, where we are on certain projects. What we do with our families, you know, what we do with our friends, you know, visiting, taking trips, and anything that you can kind of tie back to the hobby, I guess. And guys, I'll tell you, I'm going to talk about this on one of our upcoming podcast episodes because this is cool and it's fun. And so other people need to hear this and know that this is, you know, this is an active topic that's being researched, you know, in college for what you guys are doing. I bet a lot of people don't know that, but they will after listening to our show. So, we kind of weave in and out of, you know, current events and what's going on, as well as just talking about, you know, technical aspects of what it takes to fix a Qbert machine and bring one back, you know, back from the dead. So, and we do have interviews, and we do have, you know, people call in and leave us voicemail and, you know, and stuff like that. And we talk about what we've done over the past month, but we try to make it just as down home and friendly, you know, as we can, whilst trying to stay somewhat on topic and, you know, not lose all of our listeners in the process. If all we did was just talk about, oh, this is what I did this month on my Qbert machine, I don't know that would be very compelling, you know. So you try to make sure that the human element is there as much as you can.
Going back to your co-host, if you'd like to talk about like who he is, how you met him.
Oh, yeah, sure. So my co-host, his name is Brent Griffith, and Brent and I have known each other for several years now, probably, I would say, probably four or five, somewhere around in there, even though we've only been doing the podcast for almost a little bit over a year now at this point. So he and I met just as being in the scene, and we decided to start the podcast after the company that I work for and the company that he works for had some mutual business together, and so he and I were working together in that fashion, and so we were seeing each other a lot more. And he's like, "Hey, man, you know, you've got the site. He goes, you're doing good with it, but he goes, what about doing a podcast? Have you ever thought about doing that?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, I've thought about it, you know, 100 times, but I don't really have anybody to podcast with, and I didn't really want to podcast by myself, you know, and so I just." You know, I didn't really feel that would be very compelling, you know. So, you know, it's sitting in front of a mirror and just talking into a microphone. I just didn't really view that as fun, you know, month in and month out, let alone trying to make everybody else believe that it was fun. You know, so, yeah, so we just talked about it. And, you know, over the course of several months, we kind of got all the details ironed out and we started the show. I will say this, though. You know, when we started the podcast, neither one of us knew anything about podcasting. We didn't have a clue what it takes to put on a podcast. So we started talking about doing the podcast, I would say, easily 6 months before our first episode came out. So, yeah, seriously, because we had to you know, pool money together, buy gear like this and microphone stands. And, you know, dedicated laptops and stuff like that. And, you know, so we really tried to take a very methodical approach to it, I guess, so that it wasn't just kind of done on a shoestring, so that, you know, our audio would sound good and that we could, you know, that we would have a shot of actually making it through the first year without running into too many difficulties. But a lot of it we just had to teach ourselves. We had to teach ourselves as we went. So, yeah, it took a long time for us to get you know, spun up and started. But, you know, once you're going, once you kind of prime the pump, it kind of tends to go on its own, you know, to some degree.
Have you guys ever thought about making YouTube videos?
You know, we have. And it's something that I've batted around quite a bit. But, you know, there are other people that are doing the YouTube video, I guess, kind of using YouTube as a vehicle for getting, like, arcade information out. One of the most well known is a gentleman named John Jacobson, who runs a YouTube channel called John's Arcade, and man, he does like restoration videos and things like that that are just really, really good. And so, you know, I mean, other people do it as well. He's probably the most notable, probably one of the most well known, simply because of the content that he produces and everything. But yeah, we thought about it, but I'll just be very transparent on this and straight up. I just don't know that we have the time to do it, because right now with family and things like that, it would just be very hard to take more time away from everything else to start doing the YouTube video, route. And maybe at some point we will, but right now we're doing the podcast and it's going really well. And we've got our schedule ironed out to where it doesn't, you know, impact our lives all that much, you know? And so right now things are going good. So we'll see what the future holds. We've definitely thought about it though.
Yeah, definitely the video editing and everything that's come with those videos makes things a lot more difficult.
Here's the thing. It does. And we have produced some videos, okay? Like we've produced some videos of panel discussions, panel recordings for some of the expos that we've been at and things like that. And you're right, that takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, and I can spend hours downstairs in my basement, running some of the Adobe programs and, you know, Premiere and everything, yeah, essentially Premiere and Photoshop, you know, mocking up graphics and stuff like that, and all for one YouTube video. And I know that I'm not the fastest at it because I don't really have a very streamlined process. I would have to invest a lot more time to get a lot better at it, and right now it's just not something that we want to devote much time to yet.
What's your favorite thing about making podcasts?
Our favorite thing about making the podcast is definitely it's fun to research. You know, it's fun to research the topics and to learn about, you know, what we're going to cover before we cover it. But I would say by far our favorite thing about making the podcast and doing the podcast is the people that write into us and send us feedback, and that we've met at shows, and just random people that I've had, you know, stop me going down the street, you know, say, "Hey, Whitney, I listened to you, you know, on iTunes, and, you know, we're on Stitcher or something like that." And it's like, wow, I never really would have expected that, you know. And so it's the people that we've met and the friends that we've made that is by far the best thing about the podcast.
Do you have a favorite episode or any interesting stories you've
you know doing the podcast? Brent and I have stuck to our mantra that we would, you know, that we would be a show for anybody or show for everybody, and we try to feature and interview people that are not in the limelight, okay, and that are not the, you know, the super well known, you know, pinball designers or arcade high score people or something like that. Now we've had them on, we've had some of those people on our show, don't get me wrong, because that's just part of the culture, it's part of the scene, you know, but we also like to give as much time to just somebody who would be willing to sit down and talk with us about their collection and why they do what they do. Because at the end of the day, we're just two dudes with microphones, you know, and that's it. So, but to give you an answer to your question, I would say the favorite episode that I have that we've done was back in March of last year when we interviewed a gentleman by the name of John Trudeau. He is a pinball designer who works for Stern, just about 15 miles or so here up the road. Stern produces, you know, is still making just what I would consider excellent, excellent pinball machines today. And John is a veteran of that industry, a designer in that industry. He has, just recently, produced a couple of new pinball machines. He's working on one right now. And when he was in Louisville for the Louisville Arcade Expo, he was nice enough to sit down with us. And he sat with us for, I know, an hour, maybe an hour and a half, and we talked his ear off, and he was just the nicest guy. And what's great about that is I have since been able to spend time with John since last March and developed, you know, somewhat of a relationship and a friendship, and it's just been awesome. I mean, he's a great guy, and he was a great interview, and he just told just really super interesting stories about everyday life. You know, and you can only talk about what's your favorite game for so long. And then you have to pull the covers back and you have to talk about the person and about the people. And that's what people really want to hear. And that was definitely the most fun, I think the most fun episode that I've had. They're all fun. They're all fun. It's just some stick out more than others. Yeah.
So about your fans.
yeah.
Do you have a biggest fan or...
You know, I don't know. That'd be tough to say because, you know, we have fans that contact us on a fairly regular basis. We have people that we see at shows, but I'd hesitate to say that there's any one biggest fan because we want all of our fans to be our fans, you know. So I don't want to single anybody out. But I will say this. We have made several very good friendships via the shows because they were fans, you know. But I just hope we continue to get more.
Let's see. I think we've covered enough on the podcast. So, have you ever designed any games or wanted to?
Oh man, yes. I've wanted to. Okay, I've never done any game design at all. I was born too late, to be quite honest with you. The veterans of this industry, are a lot of them are still alive, but they're not. They may not be in game design any longer. I would love to get into like indie game design. I know you'd mentioned that at the onset of the interview. I would love to get into that at some point, but I just cannot devote the time to it right now. So, what I've found is I really have to kind of pick and choose what I do. And just kind of limit myself to three or four different things if I want to do any of them with any hope of any type of excellence. Otherwise, I'm just spread just completely too thin, and I get absolutely nothing done. But would I like to? Yeah, I would like to. I mean, I've had a couple of ideas floating around for years, but, you know, in order to do them justice, you would have to develop a skill set that today I just don't have.
Do you feel like anybody acts differently around you because they know you're a blogger and a... podcast?
Man, I hope not. I really hope not, because I mean, we just get together and we just record, and we do it for everybody who listens to us, and we do it because we have fun. There's no, I mean, truthfully, we're just two guys from Kentucky, you know, about as salt of the earth as you can find. Okay, there's no seeking stardom or fandom or anything associated with this at all, and I hope that no one would treat us differently because we have a show. Because at the end of the day, we just talk until we've decided we're done for the month, and then we put it out on iTunes, and that's it.
So where do you see the podcast and the blog going?
Okay, yeah, very, very, very good, question. So this is something that Brent and I've talked about, over the past year or so. We've got some plans for, you know, revamping the website and, you know, kind of upping the production quality on the show, rotating out some of the music and just stuff like that. And as far as you know, where the show will go, we really want to try to stay true to our roots and to the feedback that our listeners have given us, and the fact that they really like the show as it is today. The format, we're a long format show, so we'll record anywhere from 4 to 6 hours of content a month, and then we have a lot of people that listen to that show over the course of a couple weeks over the course of the month. And so, I mean, format-wise, I really don't see us changing a whole lot, you know, when it comes to that. What we do need to do, though, is really just kind of revamp what we are doing. And you know, we've had requests for some merchandise, you know, T-shirts and, you know, stuff like that. And so at some point we'll probably start offering those up, you know, for sale on the site, just to help support the show and to offset some of the expense. But what I would see for us long term, though, is just becoming, you know, hopefully more accepted in the community and just known for, you know, producing a good quality show that's fun, and hope that we continue to provide, you know, value for everybody listening. So I know that that's probably not, you know, the best answer in the world, but I think the only other answer I could give you is, oh yeah, so in a year we'd be doing YouTube videos, then in 2 years we would be, you know, on TV, or and then 3 years, you know, we would, you know, sell the brand. I don't think that's going to happen. So, I mean, it's a niche hobby, it's just something we love to do. So we just want to keep on doing what we're doing, kind of spruce things up and keep it fresh, and hopefully just grow our listener base. I mean, we do have listeners all over the world. We get feedback from Germany, from Australia, Italy, Spain. I mean, New England, England, the UK. Yeah, New England would be very close to us. But, England, UK, it's neat to see who all listens and the feedback that we've gotten, and we just want to keep on.
How do you guys typically get exposure or get the word out about your podcast?
Well, that's harder said than done, or I'm sorry, easier said than done. Okay, and it's harder to do than you would think it is. So, I mean, we do utilize Facebook and we do utilize Twitter, and we try to be very, very active on our Facebook page and on Twitter as well, and keep the interest of the show, or I guess the interest in the show, kind of running in between the episodes, because, you know, we release one show a month, and so that's one day that we release, let's say, 4 or 5 or 6 hours of content. That content may be consumed over the course of several days over a month, but then you have the other, let's say, 25 days that you want to keep people engaged so that they're ready for the next show, you know? So we utilize social media. We do have the website, but that's, you know, that's mostly just for, you know, like special announcements and just, you know, episode hosting and things like that. And then we also, you know, maintain some threads on some of the arcade collector forums and things like that. And so whenever we produce a new show, or I'm sorry, release a new show, we'll go through and hit all the threads on the local collector boards and things like that, and post it to Facebook and Twitter and things along those lines. And then we're hosted on, we're available via Spotify and iTunes, and
Another network that we just got recently accepted into called the Throwback Network, which is like an aggregation network of like-minded or like content podcasts to help other listeners and other show listeners find you and to like expose other people to your show and grow your listenership. So that's what we do. I mean, there's really no science to it, and every month we wind up doing something a little bit different just because. You know, it's, something's a little bit out of order or, let's go ahead and hit the forums first or Facebook first or whatever. But that's it. I wish I could say there was more science to it than there is, but there's not.
What would you say is the biggest thing that you've learned about the gaming industry?
The biggest thing that I've learned about the gaming industry is that in its heyday, it was bigger than any other industry, entertainment industry, at the time. So when you think about the movie industry or the music industry or anything like that, 30 years ago, this industry was huge. I mean, huge. And what I've learned is that you cannot discount the past so easily, and there's always lessons to be learned from looking back. Because this industry was the beginning of just a massive, massive global industry today. So when you look at what Microsoft does, and when you look at what Sony does, and when you look at what Nintendo does, Nintendo was there back in the day, okay? You know, because Nintendo as a company has been around for 100 years, not doing video games, but doing many other things. But when you think about where we are today, you know, the global video game industry would not exist as we see it today had it not been for those machines standing up, you know, across the room here, you know, running a quarter at a time. So what I've learned is that everything may look really neat and flashy today, but there's always a starting point, and it's always good to remember your roots.
Let's ask it.
Yeah.
Is there something you could wish that you wish you could change about the game industry?
If there's anything that I wish that I could change, is that it would thrive today like it did 30 years ago. That's what I would love to see, the return to a simpler time. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with the console industry as it is today, or the entertainment industry as it is today. You know, my thoughts on that, you know, good or bad, you know, notwithstanding, you know, those industries are what they are. I would just like to see, I'd like to see the arcade and the pinball industry just really see a revival in us get back to, just some simpler things, I guess, in life, you know, when it truly was just, a quarter at a time and you play for 3 or 4 minutes, and it was a very social thing. It was something where people would gather around and, you know, scream and yell and have a good time and compete and everything like that. I think a lot of that is missing. You know, it's far too easy just to sit in front of your chair and just work your thumbs and just, you know, game with a headset and the internet. And that's not even an option for the industry as it was 30 years ago. I know we can't turn back the hands of time, but if I could wish it cool again like that, that's what I'd do.
So this is a difficult question, because I believe gaming culture probably isn't very definable.
I'm just watching the batteries here. Okay. At some point, what we'll do is we'll have to stop this. I think I'm gonna have to swap the batteries out, and then we'll pick it back up. Okay. I'm not watching for time. I'm just watching the battery meter. That's all.
Yeah. Just let me know.
Yeah.
So, how and if you can, would you define gaming culture? I know there's many subcultures of gaming.
Yeah.
Culture, but how would you define gaming culture?
I define gaming culture as the group of people that are committed to honoring the things that they loved from their childhood and that are willing to make the time investment, the monetary investment, and even the lifestyle investment in order to make sure that a part Americana is not lost for good. That's what I define the gaming culture as, or at least, as it is in these circles, from the classic arcade gaming culture and pinball culture. I think that they're a group of men and women who have decided that just because you grow up doesn't mean you can't have fun any longer, and they're committed to
having that fun and in a way that they remember having it. And so,
and you know, when I look at it too, I mean, these are pieces of history, you know, and because they're not made any longer, once they're gone, they're gone. So for the people that preserve them, they are in their own way historians. And so that's really how I look at the culture. Now, just like you said, there's offshoots, and there's the high score community. There's the, you know, there's the you know, just the player community. There is the restoration community. There's the pinball only community, the arcade only community. But at the end of the day, they all fall under one bigger umbrella.
What do you see as the biggest issue with modern gaming?
Biggest issue with modern gaming? My opinion is that it has traded flashy graphics and scripted theatrical gameplay and the desire to try to, hey man, I don't know if I'll be flamed for saying this or not, but it has attempted to trade theatrics for substance, okay? That's the biggest problem that I see today. I can name very few games, not even on one hand, the games that I think that have stayed true to gaming roots rather than being a scripted technology showcase, okay, for the consoles. Yes, the games may look good, but they lack a certain soul, you know, and they lack a certain flair to them, I guess. And you know, once you solve one of the modern games, where's the replayability? Where's the replay value? Are you really ever going to go back and play Call of Duty Modern Warfare 7 times in a row? People are still playing Donkey Kong 30 years later. Now, of course, you know, there's a huge difference when you stack those two together, but I will say this. You know, Donkey Kong stands for it's still here for a reason, and I'm not so sure that people 30 years from now are going to be looking back and saying that, you know, X, Y, or Z, you know, was that pivotal that it had that character, it had its own essence, you know. So I think that complexity has not been the gaming industry's friend. Now it may be the publisher's friend, you know, and it may be, you know, from an economic standpoint, I'm sure it drives a lot of sale and a lot of money, which is good, you know. I mean, capitalism is a great thing, but from a gamer standpoint, I think the simpler days were the better days.
What do you want people to gain and learn from you and your podcast?
What I would like, or what I would hope that people would gain or learn, is that anyone can do whatever it is they want to do, regardless of how esoteric it may seem or it may appear to other people. I mean, I'm a grown man who collects arcade games, and people probably attach a stigma to that. But at the same point in time, you know, we all have things that we like, and I would just want everybody who listens to just stay true to their passion and follow your passion and do what you love, and you know, do it well, and you know, reach out to others in your community, and you know, make new friends and be, you know, be good to each other and grow. You know, grow the community, and everybody will prosper. So that's what I would hope people get from our podcast. Not the technical items aside, and yes, you know, whatever topics we may cover, maybe whatever they are, 1 month to the next. But what I would want the lasting overtone to be is that, you know, we're all friends, and let's just have fun. Let's talk about it, and let's use the podcast as a vehicle to, you know, to be better for all of us.
So here's our last question.
Okay.
Is there anything that you would like to mention or talk about? Anything that we haven't covered so far? Anything that you wanted to tell me?
I've got a question for you guys. So why are you guys conducting an interview on an industry that was in its heyday 30 years ago. What has led you guys to talk to me, and why this topic, and why not doing an interview? Why aren't you doing an interview on modern gaming today and talking to somebody from Microsoft or Sony or something like that? Why the focus on this? I'm kind of curious because this fits within some of the resurgence that we've seen over the past few years, and the simple fact that we're all sitting around this table talking about this particular topic is proof of that. So I'm kind of curious, what led you guys here?
So I think our class mostly is about the culture of gaming, and the only way to really understand the culture of gaming is going to its roots and being able to understand, you know, everything and where it came from. You know, since I started gaming since the 90s, I didn't have the full experience of all of gaming, but I definitely was able to see, you know, where it came from, the simplicity from certain Sega games and Nintendo games. And there's always been a certain nostalgia and you know, my own history involved with that I've cherished and I've really wanted to relate back to.
Okay.
And there's a lot, like you've mentioned, that is lost in modern gaming.
Yeah.
That I think this class really does a good job of covering. And
that's good. That's good. I can't wait to, you know, I can't wait to hear the interview or see the transcript of the interview or what have you, because yeah, I find this topic insanely interesting, and I think it's just really, really nice that it's receiving some modern attention. So I'd say, you know, kudos to you guys for, you know, for going down this path, because it's just not one that people just really seem to pay attention to anymore.
Is there anything you guys wanted to say?
Pass the microphone.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth.
Hey, Elizabeth.
I think what's really, really important about why we're doing this or talking more about it is that a lot of the things that I learned from taking this class and from speaking with you, I never knew before. Like,
okay.
I didn't understand the importance of coin-operated video games or the coin-op industry in general.
Yes.
I feel like a lot of these games make a lot of the media that we have today, not let alone just video games, but even movie culture or books or art. But I feel like a lot of it needs to be illuminated on and exaggerated on, because it is what created a lot of things. And I feel like the stigma and stereotypes of the coin-op industry, and maybe even people who play video games, aren't viewed as important as they should be, because it has a bad stereotype. It doesn't necessarily have the most important stereotype as it should have. So
and you know, and I think you've touched on a very important topic there, you know, or facet of the topic, is that, you know, whatever stigma is there about the coin-op industry, I think it's somewhat unfairly earned, because you know, these games were new. This blasted on the scene in 80 and 81 and 82 and took America by storm. And I just think, you know, the public, just never having been exposed to something like that, they didn't really know how to take everything. Now today, if we were to reintroduce these games today, they would fly so completely under the radar. You know, we've been, I don't want to say desensitized to that, to media, but we have, you know, to some degree. And the controversy, the stigma, the everything, I just don't think it would be there like it was 30 years ago. And so I think it's a good point, and you're right. These are historical pieces, and this was the beginning of a huge, huge industry, and it does deserve to be documented, and I think at least understood, and then let everybody draw whatever conclusion they want to out of that. But I think it is fairly misunderstood in many cases.
What was the question again?
It could be any question you want.
Okay.
Yeah.
The reason why I'm here, I think, is because my mother was pretty big into coin-op games.
She was?
Yeah.
So did she play back in the arcades back in the day?
I'm not sure. I actually don't know much about that, but she had picked up some, like, pinball machines in arcade games. So when I was growing up, I'd...
Oh, kudos to your mom. You've got a cool mom. That's all right.
Yeah, like, sitting right there, the Bobby Orr machine. She had that one for a while.
Oh, nice.
But we actually sold it off when it tripled in value when the Blackhawks came black. So
I can understand that.
Yeah.
Well, that's neat. So at least you've got, you know, at least you've got some familiarity with it. So yeah, that's good. A lot of kids today don't, you know, and really never will unless they visit a place like this or just become interested, you know, in the hobby and in the game, you know, in gaming in general. Yeah, that's cool.
I don't have anything else. So,
no, thank you guys for your time. I hope you've gotten what you needed out of the interview. It's always fun for me to kind of sit back and rewind through the years and just, you know, think about this and talk about it. But I've had a great time. I appreciate you all having me on.
Well, we thank you very much for your time. It was definitely a learning experience for us, and it was well worth taking the class and everything involved with it. And it was definitely a pleasure to be able to speak with you and learn from you.
Well, thank you. Same for me, and I appreciate you that you guys were interested in it. So I would say play some games before you leave today.
Definitely, we're planning on it. We were actually playing the Vector Graphics Star Wars before.
Oh, isn't that awesome? It is. It's so neat. It's so neat. And just the hardware behind that and the you know, just the engineering for 30 years ago to produce something like that. Each machine is almost a feat, you know, a marvel in and of itself, really.
Yeah
neat stuff.
Yeah. So we'll definitely be playing some of the older games, especially I think we've gained some appreciation for them through the class.
Yeah, play some new pinball too, man. You know, there's a Walking Dead machine back there and a Tron and everything else. I mean, Star Trek, AC/DC. There's some really killer pinball machines back there. So, yeah, hit those too. They're a lot of fun.
Definitely.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.